Coming up on this week's book show, Andrew McCarthy's movie roles in Pretty in Pink, St. Elmo's Fire, Weekend at Bernie's, and Less Than Zero made him a star. He's considered one of the so-called Brat Pack, which has come to represent both a genre of film and an era of pop culture. He writes of that decade in his new book, Brat, an 80s Story, Andrew McCarthy, on this week's book show. Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Andrew McCarthy's movie roles in Pretty in Pink, St. Elmo's Fire, Weekend at Bernie's, and Less Than Zero made him a star. He's considered one of the so-called Brat Pack, that iconic group of ingenues and heartthrobs that included Rob Lowe, Molly Ringwald, Emilio Estevez, and Demi Moore, and others, and has come to represent both a genre of film and an era of pop culture. In his memoir, Brat, an 80s Story, McCarthy focuses his gaze on that singular moment in time. The result is a revealing look at coming of age in a maelstrom, reckoning with conflicted ambition, innocence, and addiction. It is a great pleasure to welcome author, director, and actor Andrew McCarthy to the book show. How are you, sir?
Good, Joe. How are you?
I'm well. I so greatly enjoyed this book. First of all, and I told you this, I think the last time you were on the program when we were talking about the travel memoir, you are such a gifted writer. It's often very spare, but the language just is so beautiful and picturesque. And I'm curious as to how much you pore over that.
Well, thank you. I suppose because I wasn't particularly well educated in school, I didn't give much time or care to school. And by the time I went to college, I was only interested in acting. So I was only there a few years. I always felt undereducated. And, you know, I didn't do well in high school. So I felt stupid because I didn't fit into the school box. And so when I started writing, and when that just sort of happened to me and emerged in my life, I was careful to just try and tell the story because I didn't feel I had the tool chest, the skills, you know? And I was always very actively aware of trying to write a good sentence with a comma when needed, you know? And things, because I always felt like I did, you know, an academic's inferiority complex, you know what I mean? My style emerged from that insecurity of just tell the story, tell it clean, to be detail oriented and specific as you can be, because that creates a visual, you know, that, and I think if you can make people imagine and visualize why they're reading, then you're doing something.
In the promotion of this book, it's often referred to as a literary memoir, which just makes me, it's a reminder to us all that that means that you wrote it.
Although I have to tell you, I was reading I was doing a narration for the audiobook, and I was making so many mistakes because it goes back to my school thing where I used to, when I was a little kid and had to read out loud, I hated reading so much out loud, and I made so many mistakes and I felt so dumb that I was making so many mistakes reading it that the engineer I was working with said, "I'm sorry, did you write this book?" And I'm like, "Yeah, no, I did. I promise I did. I read this sentence before. I wrote this sentence."
I listened along. I was reading while I was listening along to it, which I often do. And I was curious because there were several times where the text changes, but obviously you're doing it. You wrote it. So it's approved by you. That's good. But it reads easier.
It's funny. I I didn't think of, I did change some things as I was reading. I go, wait, that's not good. I'm going to simplify this, or I'm going to change. Yeah, I did do that. And I didn't have to ask anybody's permission.
It's all you. That's great. When obviously writing is solitary, and you are very well known for a medium that is a group project. And I'm curious as to what drew you to that initially. You talk about those early days and the first time on stage and how seductive that was. But what was it about that project of being with others?
Well, I tend to be a very solitary person, and the older I get, the worse it gets. But, you know, the acting, it just, when I walked out on stage as the Artful Dodger and Oliver, my first part in high school, I did feel that sense of discovery of, my God, there I am, and felt complete in a way that I'd never had before. And that was a huge relief to me. So that's just what I pursued. You know, I think there are a lot of actors that are quite introverted anyway. There are certain kinds, you know, I'm not a performer per se. Like, I know certain performers who love to be out there and love to put it out there. And it's not what acting to me is. Acting is much more sort of a revealing of something and an intimacy that happens. There are different styles, of course. That happens to be the kind that I like, is that kind of intimate revealing and disclosing of something that is universal, hopefully. But it doesn't require a personality type.
The titles of the chapters are interesting to me. Awash in It, Discovering It, Igniting It. Did you define what it was at the beginning?
That's interesting. There weren't titles for a while. It is just like that overriding thing that happened to me. And it is that, you know, it's fame, it's the spark, it's the it is just sort of the why we live, you know? You know, I don't know. But they just evolved that way. It was is an unspoken or undefined kind of yearning, and it's that thing. I wouldn't know how to describe it.
Yeah, because it could be the career, it could be the profession, it obviously could be your love of the craft itself, your own issues, your inner fortitude.
Yeah, it's all that. You know, it's like the same way the title is Brat, is just like, it's a certain way of owning that, and sort of hopefully in a certain way it's ironic, and it wasn't ironic because it was slammed in your face, and it's as in your face as it felt at the time to be slapped with it when that label was cast upon, flung on us. You know, when I was writing the book, someone gave it to a friend to read the first draft, and he said, and I didn't have a title. I said, what are you going to call it? He said, I have no idea. And he said, well, there's only one title for this book. And he said, what, dude? Tell me. And he said, it's Brat. To which my initial response was, there's no way that this book is going to be called Brat. Okay. And then what was so helpful about that was because it made me realize, oh, I haven't done my work here. I have not finished doing my work. Because really the book is all of it. That's all that the book is about. And coming to terms with what that means to me. And I, you know, I hadn't been able to coalesce that thought until I went away from that conversation of what does it mean to me? And, you know, what it's become, like those movies are so iconic, like you said, to a certain generation, and they represent, it's not just the movies, they represent the youth of that generation in such a specific way. And I am like an avatar of those people's youth. And that, it turned out to be a gift, which I didn't really realize on a conscious level till my friend said that. And I went back and I thought, well, what is this? Why am I still resisting this? And then when I realized what a gift it was to be that avatar for those people's youth, mm-hmm. Like, wow, that's a long journey to travel from being called a Brat Packer to, like, I represent one of the most glorious moments of young people's lives.
It's fascinating because that, as you mentioned, came out of a New York Magazine article, which I don't think I'm hurting anybody's feelings, but it wasn't that great of an article. And
whether it was well written or not, it was a scathing article about
it. It was a scathing article, and it didn't, you weren't really even mentioned. I think you had one mention in the article, is that right?
I was mentioned once in the article. Yeah, it evolved from Emilio Estevez was doing a small promo piece in New York Magazine for St. Elmo's Fire that was coming out. And he made an ill-advised decision to invite a writer to come with him out drinking with Judd Nelson and Rob Lowe at the Hard Rock Cafe. And they behaved the way young guys, you know, who are in the movies and successful and drinking behave. And he turned off to his subject and wrote this nasty article about it. And, you know, the amazing thing is the title, the name, the phrase is so good. It latches in so deep and so quickly, only if you say it once and you know it. And what I resented about it at the time was that it became, you know, you're instantly boxed. Once you're boxed and defined, people stop looking at it and trying to understand it or even think about it anymore. It just is that. Oh, you're that. And as an actor or as a human, well, no one really wants that. No one wants to be utterly defined by the way you are for a night or a little bit when you're 21 years old. And so, you know, it's a lot to overcome for people like me. I mean, other guys just sort of rolled with it easier than I did. I think I took it personally in a way that was a waste of my time.
Well, it seems difficult not to take it personally because it had such an impact on all of your careers.
But also, again, one of the things that's evolved about that's so sort of a blessed about it now is that we wouldn't be having this conversation, even if I'd done the same movies and they were exactly the same success that they had. If the term Brat Pack hadn't been coined, I don't think we'd probably be talking now, because it's come to represent, like you were talking about earlier, this moment in time or this in pop culture and this for a group.
Your first film was Class in the 80s. Tell us about that coming to and really learning about film through that work with Rob Lowe and Jacqueline Bisset.
Well, I mean, I have to back up to how I got the part, which is I'd just been kicked out of NYU after 2 years, and a friend of mine called me up and said, you know, there's an ad in the Backstage magazine, which is the unemployed actors newspaper, which I didn't get. My friend said, there's an ad, they're making a movie and they're looking for the lead actor, 18, vulnerable and sensitive. And I was like, dude, that's me. I'm 18, vulnerable and sensitive. So I went up to the audition when there were 500 other 18 vulnerable and sensitive kids there. And I, anyway, eventually auditioned for this movie like 8-10 times. And then I was plucked from the weeds and I was flown out to California to meet Jacqueline Bisset because she had approached to play her young lover. And so it was to play. So I had to meet her because she had to approve of me. And I went up to her house and said something and I don't know what. And she just kind of looked at the producer and said, oh, he's cheeky. I like him. I was like, oh, okay. And anyway, and then I was in the movies and, you know, I was so unformed. I was like an amoeba or something. They'd say, well, okay, hit your mark over there. And I'm like, my what? You know, the piece of tape, go stand on it. I was like, oh, okay. I knew nothing, you know, so it was a steep learning curve.
While I was reading the book, the other project that I tasked myself with, which was a great pleasure, was watching all the films that you did in the 80s, starting with Class and ending up with Weekend at Bernie's, which is pretty much how you leave it in the book, although you you also talk about playing Henry Miller too toward the end. And I'm curious as to how you look at it, because you are very introspective and how you feel about these films, what went right and what went wrong. And it seems from your telling in the book that the first movie that, yes, it perhaps didn't do well, but the one that you felt good in was Heaven Help Us.
Yeah, and I love that movie. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I think it's probably the best movie I did in the 80s, certainly. I think it's a good story and well done. But yes, that was the second movie that I did. I'd done a little TV thing between Class and that. But yeah, that was the movie where I kind of realized I just became comfortable on a movie set, you know, and started to learn and started to fill my space, you know, and wasn't just sort of overawed by it and feeling completely overwhelmed. I enjoyed that experience a lot.
Andrew McCarthy is our guest. The name of the new book is Brat, an 80s Story. It is published by Grand Central. That led then to St. Elmo's Fire. And then you start working with all the aforementioned Brat Pack members. I mean, that was the giant collection, if you will, of that group. It seems as though there's basically two classifications when you are describing your relationships with people. It's either you become incredibly, you have a crush and you're smitten with them from a distance, or you feel a gulf and you either have never seen them again, or if you have, it's still very much momentary and nothing that you go back to.
Well, I mean, you know, like I said, most of my friends in life are not actors. So, and I always felt a bit like I was entering in from a side door in all things. And that was a position that I kind of liked in a certain way. And I did feel this kind of distance between people. And often I would just go to, and I would find it easier to do work when I was at a distance with you. We became intimate. It would sort of cloud the work. I suppose it's that sort of friendly but not familiar kind of thing. And I often did just feel like I was just passing through. And I liked that feeling. I wasn't looking for more out of them. I wasn't looking for relationships and things with actors or I never felt a real kinship with actors per se. I didn't dislike, but that's why when I started directing, I segued in directing some years ago, and I always liked hanging out with the crew more in a certain way than I did hanging out with the actors. And not because I didn't like actors, I just felt separate from them somehow. Not excluded by them, but just separate from them. And that was probably my own doing, you know, probably wanting to have some kind of position of uniqueness or something. I don't know. And I wasn't aware of any of that until even in writing the book. There were so many times when, like you said, and I never saw them again. And that was the last time I saw them. And I'm like, wow, I did. It was so sort of transient. But, you know, it's a corny life. You know, it is like being, it's one job to the next, about 150 jobs in my life. And you just pass through one to the next so many times. And that's just my experience of it. And I like that experience of it. I like sort of going off, doing it, and going back to my life.
Does it ever impact, I mean, I realize it's acting, so that's the whole point, but does it ever impact the work in the sense of that personal relationship? You were in two films with Molly Ringwald. There was, you say you were never really close. And one of the things that you write about that I thought was fascinating about that was there was also a real age difference. And in the first movie, Pretty in Pink, she had already kind of developed a formula with John Hughes and knew what she was doing.
Well, and you know, when you're 22 and someone's 18, that's sudden they're 17, that's an age difference. Now in life, that's not really much of an age difference, but at that moment it is, you know. And again, in that, I had to try and figure out where I fit in this formula, because Molly was very much the most equal among equals. And her and John had an intimacy and a shorthand, and I was coming in and I wanted to try and figure out a way that I could have an impact and not just be an interchangeable John, the guy who comes in now for the John Hughes movie. So I wanted to try and create my own space there. And how I've always done that is to sort of dip in and then just sort of, you know, without it, and again, it was unconscious at the time, but I kept it, you know, the presentation is of aloofness, when much of the time that aloofness was a mask for fear, you know. And so it's better to present as aloof than fearful, because fearful is, you know, precarious feeling, whereas an aloofness to me is somewhat guarded and stuff. But and I also thought it gave me a sense, in that particular instance, gave me a sense of having a little bit of power, whereas they held all the cards, and I wanted to have maybe he's got one of his own. He seems to be holding something back, you know, and that was effective in that particular instance.
What was it?
In fact, I had no card at all, but I was just, you know.
Did you feel like you had a card?
Did I feel like I had a card? I did. I felt, you know, those movies, that movie in St. Elmo's Fire particularly, I was at that moment in life when you're just sort of blossoming, you know, and there is something about that moment that is even, it's so transitory, but it's so powerful and so attractive, you know, and it's nothing to do with acting, like say in the book there, I think it's not nothing, it's a quality that one has, and it's of just awakening that is just really attractive. And I happened, and it was captured on screen in real time with me at that moment, you know.
Because you talk about John Hughes, I've read a lot about John Hughes. I've been fascinated by his career, and being one of the aforementioned people who, you know, you were you were one of my avatars. So of watching the films as I was growing up, you're one of the few people that I've ever heard talk about a differentiation in his work of some of the because he came from National Lampoon, that those movies like Ferris Bueller and 16 Candles and Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink, digging into the teen psyche of being very much a mirror, if you will, to his experience growing up.
Well, I think that's really interesting in that no one seems to have discussed. Yeah, John, his early career, like you say, was National Lampoon, kind of crass, funny stuff. And then he shows like 5 years where he just, apparently, I didn't know John very well, but he was a very kind of raw and, you know, solitary kid in his own Chicago suburban thing. But anyway, he reveals himself and dives into these kind of adolescent emotions and gives them such respect, which is why the movies are successful, because he honors those. You know, it's like my son is 19 years old and he's in love for the first time. And I can promise you, no one has ever been in love before my son. You know what I mean? He feels it so deep. And the way I did, the way you did, the way we all did at that time, it is so important and so for the first time. And John recognized that and honored that and gave respect for those. He didn't look from it as from an adult's point of view, going, oh, they're just kids, you'll get over it. It's like, no, that really mattered. And that's what people responded to, in my opinion. And so John made himself quite vulnerable in those several movies. And then that's enough. It was too much. And he went really and hid behind his sort of facile, clever, fast, witty ways again with Uncle Buck and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and Home Alone and these glib kind of movies that were funny and terrific in their own way, but they didn't have the heart that these movies did. And I understand it because I felt the same way to a large degree. You expose yourself like that, your vulnerabilities like that, which is what I was doing in the movies too, and that John did to a greater degree in all those movies. And you're in a position to be poached, and you are in a very precarious kind of vulnerable state. And I found it too much to stay exposed like that for too long. And a couple of years was plenty. And, you know, people are coming at you. And I my pop psychology analysis of John is a similar thing, that he just retreated back, like, enough of that. And then after that was even too much. And he just took all his toys and he went home and never be heard again, you know? And I think enough's enough, he felt. But I understand that sort of exposing yourself, that vulnerability, and then kind of going, this is a lot.
I want to talk more about you than I do about him, but I do also think, I mean, don't you think that probably had something to do with the Brat Pack label too? That he kind of created that and was one of the reasons for Retreat?
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, I mean, he was such a part of those films that were considered that were vehicles for members of the Brat Pack.
Yeah, but the very label, the Brat Pack itself, just it ensured the dissolution of the Brat Pack, because the second it came out, no one wanted to be in an ensemble movie anymore of those kids. So that was one of the ironies of it, is that the becoming of it ended it. And John, I think John recalled from that too. It's I think he went and goes, enough of this. I just wasn't in a position to be able to navigate it particularly well when it happened.
You write about your alcoholism and the real correlation that it had to the time, and pop psychiatry here, but did you think that one of the reasons that you often didn't want to talk or kind of shied away from that label and wanting to do something else was you had to fully come to terms with yourself and being an alcoholic?
Well, there's so many things in there. The first thing I say to it always is I didn't drink as a reaction to becoming famous or successful in those movies or being in the Brat Pack. So many people want to easily put alcohol abuse into, well, this is what happened, so he did that. Right. It's a reaction to it. And it just simply was not the case in my experience. I drank because I drank, and I had an affinity for alcohol, and I had an alcoholic temperament, and I drank. It affected my movie career in an adverse way, but it was not brought about by my success. You know, and I think that was an important thing for me to know and to own, and that took some time to do. I never thought that I drank because of my movies, but, you know, they're interwoven. For sure. But one, you know, the success did not cause the drink. The drink existed of itself.
Well, I mean, that is part of it, is that it wasn't, it didn't have to do with the success. It had to do with you and a lot with.
And look, I was a very fearful person and very.
Right.
I wasn't aware even at the time when all that success was happening that it was that successful. You know, we weren't making gobs of money. I wasn't offered lots of movies. I was always auditioning for the next job. And, you know, it was just about sort of going to the next thing. And I very much operated with, like I mentioned in the book, like a freelancer's mentality of just get the next job. And that, so my eyes were on the ground for the next crumb in front of me. I didn't really have the vision to look up to the horizon, and sort of see and take this all in. Whereas, you know, someone like Rob Lowe was much more attuned to that kind of, and embraced all that much more. I found it very precarious feeling. And I didn't like that feeling precarious and unsafe.
The book ends at the end of the decade. Do you think you would write more about more of your career and of directing, or does this feel good?
I'm surprised. A lot of people have been like, it should have been more about your travel writing, how that happened and your drink. I'm surprised by that and kind of flattered by that, because I always thought the only thing people have ever cared about and asked about is the Brat Pack, you know? So, you know, once I found the structure of the 80s for the book, it was very clear what the book was about. I didn't know, because people forever have asked me to write a book about the Brat Pack, and I was always no. And once I kind of realized it started, and the second I walked into New York in 1980 and ended really when I was in 1989, that was that time. Once I found the structure of the time and place, because New York's a lot of character in that, and my being in New York during the 80s is very part all tied up in that, I knew what the book was then. Instead of like, what do I write about the Brat Pack? But once I had the structure of the time and place, it helped. But I don't know that it's that. When I write a book about the next chapter, God, I don't want to become a serial memoirist. I hope not. I mean, enough of me.
One of the things that I thought was fascinating too is when I closed the book, one of the images that kept coming back to me. But you talk about making the movie Kansas, and you take over this bar and a hotel in Lawrence, Kansas, and it's the party and everybody's there and the circus is in town. And then the movie's over. And at some point you say to all your friends in New York and Hollywood, hey, let's go, and we're going to go to Kansas. And you go to Kansas and the party's over. Bar is done.
Depressing basement hotel bar. And I'm like, wait a minute, what happened? Yeah.
That's a circus type mentality, right? That is the show's moved on. Even in your telling of that story, you then get in the car and move on to the next gig.
But that's the beauty of life. You know what I mean? You just don't grab hold of anything too much. I mean, you know, it just goes on to the next, and good or bad, it's going to pass.
There was a lot of cocaine in the car, but that was another story.
You know, it was the 80s.
it was the 80s. The name of the book is Brat, an 80s story. It is published by Grand Central. Andrew McCarthy, it is a great honor and pleasure to speak to you. I am a great admirer of your work, and it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Oh, thanks, Ed. I'm a big fan of the show, so thanks for having me.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.